So I was asked to talk about CMB secondaries, and I really like the logic of the organizers putting a primary on the first day, and today we have a day concentrated on secondaries.
Tomorrow.
And tomorrow we move on to something else. And so I'm going to be talking about secondaries, and in particular on work we've done recently with these people here. And I color-coded the Davis graduate students in cyan, and also one undergraduate who's I've been working with us, who's actually a Berkeley undergraduate, but he came to Davis for the summer. And so let me get started. So I don't want to just catalog what the different secondary effects are and how you calculate them and how well we know them. But I want to talk about how you can use them to do interesting science. And so really I'm talking about applications of secondary effects. And because I wanted to that to include as much ground as possible, I took a very broad definition of secondary. So it's anything that's not primary. Any alteration slash creation of CMB anisotropy after last scattering and the onset of matter domination. The last part just to rule out early ISW. So there are several secondary effects. One which is of great interest is lensing. And it's of great interest because I think that I'll get into it later. There are several applications of lensing that we've been thinking about recently, and which I'll talk about. And then with galaxy clusters and scattering of photons, CMB photons, as they pass through galaxy clusters, the CMB gives us a way of studying galaxy clusters and removing and deducing things like the baryon fraction galaxy clusters, what the number of clusters is as a function of redshift, what the power spectrum of clusters is, what the peculiar velocities of clusters are. And at least all these last three things then relate, have some sensitivity to the matter content and the mystery of dark energy. And in addition to studying particular objects highlighted by the CMB, there are these diffuse backgrounds. There must be a pointer. The thermal SZ effect which is just this diffuse background from all the clusters and groups between here and last scattering, and which has a remarkable property of scaling like sigma 8 to the 7th, and we'll have talks today about possible detections of this background and attempts to actually use that to measure sigma 8 and how that compares to other ways to measure sigma 8. And there's also a separate Sinyaev-Zel'dovich effect, which I'll talk about, which is the kinematic Sinyaev-Zel'dovich effect. And this, no one is claiming a detection of this yet, but this scales like sigma 8 to the 4th. So possibly we'll have yet another value of sigma 8 someday coming from that. And finally, photons scatter off the electrons in the reionized intergalactic medium, and in particular produce an interesting signature in the polarization of the CMB. And this signature can be used to probe deeper into the dark ages than can be done with, for example, Gunn-Peterson troughs in quasar spectra. And I'll talk some about that. Now, I can't talk about all these things, so I'm just going to talk about the things that I've been working on recently. And so that's lensing, peculiar velocities that Sarah Church talked about yesterday, and reionization. So, lensing. The effect of lensing can be described with as a deflection angle map. So there's a there's a map on the sky of deflection angle. It says take this point and map it over here, take this point and map it over here, and that's D. And the effect of lensing is to take an unlensed intensity map and shift it by D to create the lens map, which is the one we observe. Same thing goes for the other, for the other Stokes parameters. And this deflection angle is the gradient of a scalar field, which is nice. It's easier to work with scalar fields than tensor fields. And this lensing potential is a projection of the 3D gravitational potential. Now, this is in real space. Qualitatively, the effects of lensing in Fourier space are that you can create this B-mode polarization out of E-mode that, for example, Nils talked about yesterday, and, of course, vice versa. Now, this this is unfortunate, right, because we wanted this B-mode signal to be a signature of gravity waves, but here we see scalar perturbations can lead to B because of lensing. That's unfortunate, but there's another effect as well, which is it leads to correlation in the spherical harmonic coefficients at different wave numbers, which is proportional to the lensing potential at the difference of those wave numbers. And you can use this fact to build an estimator for the lensing potential. You look for correlations between these guys above the noise of just the fact that they're fluctuating anyway, and use that to build an estimator for phi. And some minimum variance estimators have been proposed recently in these papers. Okay, so I already hinted at the first application of lensing. What do we do with this lensing? And it can be used to help us detect tensor perturbations. Let me explain that here with this series of plots. So here is the scalar temperature perturbation angular power spectrum. And here is the tensor temperature perturbation angular power spectrum, which whose amplitude we parameterize relative to the scalar. This little r is the ratio of at the quadrupoles of tensor to scalar, and here I plotted it for 10 to the minus 3. And there's no way of seeing this contribution to the total angular power spectrum in temperature because it's just too small and you're swamped by cosmic variance. You have this huge contaminating scalar signal that's preventing you from seeing the tensor signal. It's interesting for other reasons, but it's a pain for seeing the tensor signal. But as pointed out by Kamin, Kaskic, Sasek, and Stebbins, and Seljak and Sildarayaga, there is a curl mode or B mode polarization pattern that is not generated by scalar perturbations in linear theory, but is generated by gravitational waves. And there is no big scalar noise here, and you can see it, except there is a scalar noise due to lensing. So Nils showed you what an E-mode looks like. If you then put a deflection angle map on that and distort it, some of that E-mode, some of it becomes B-mode. And here's the power spectrum of that you expect from the lensing between here and last scattering. So once again, obscuring the tensor signal. But you can reconstruct the potential. And from the because of the coupling between AL and AL prime, reconstruct the potential and so get the deflection angle from the gradient of that lensing potential. And then take your lensed maps and convert them into unlensed maps because you know what the deflection angle is. You can recreate the unlensed map. And in an unlensed map, there's no lensing effects. So there's no I can't point at my screen, that doesn't help. There's no scalar B mode, except of course we didn't do it perfectly, and so there's a residual scalar B mode power. And in fact, there's a limit, no matter how perfectly you measure, there's a limit to how well you can clean out, how well you can reconstruct this projected potential, and so a limit to how well you can clean out the scalar B modes. And that leads to this fact that if the energy scale of inflation is greater than about 2 × 10^15 GeV, you'll be able to detect it. Well, there's a chance of detecting it. If it's less than this, then there's no hope. And since we don't know what the energy scale of inflation is, we better come up with other reasons, as was mentioned yesterday. other uses of lensing as well. We don't want to motivate our efforts all on going after this gravity wave signal. So let's look for other applications. Another application of the lensing potential is to cross-correlate it with other tracers of large-scale structure. And so what's nice about this lensing potential is that it's due to structure over a broad range of redshifts, from z equals 4 or 3 to peaking at around between 2 and 3, and also to nearby. I'll show you a picture of the window later. And so therefore it correlates with many other tracers of this large-scale structure. And I'm just going to show you one example. So there's a far infrared background, which is arising from emission from dusty galaxies, maybe some contribution from AGNs as well. And so these sources, to some degree, must trace the large-scale structure. And so their fluctuations will be correlated with the lensing potential, which is also due to the large-scale structure. And so we can model the far infrared background in a Rayleigh jeans temperature as being some mean component plus the fluctuation. So this is this mean emissivity, and these constants are just for converting into Rayleigh jeans from intensity. And so there's this key thing here, is this window function showing you where in the co-moving space, or we could also plot this in redshift, the signal's coming from. And this is the what the weighting function looks like for this line of sight projection for several different frequencies of the far infrared background. And here it is for lensing. And so we can take, we can then use the Limber approximation to calculate the different angular power spectra. And in particular, here's this cross-angular power spectrum. And you can see that you'd expect something significant here because there is some degree of overlap between the lensing window and the far infrared background window. So the part of space that's giving rise to lensing is also giving rise to far infrared background fluctuations. And here's a calculation of this cross-correlation power spectrum. This is for some fiducial halo model and then error bars that you get you'd expect for Planck. This includes an elementary treatment of dust contamination. So the point is that you can learn, you take this, the great thing about the lensing potential is it's something that we can calculate really well ab initio. And so when we correlate it with other things, and we can learn, it's a way of learning about these other things. And in this case, you take different, say, halo model parameters, and you get different results here, and you can discriminate between the different models. Okay, here's the third application. And this is to study the evolution of the growth factor that Max talked about yesterday from early times, from last scattering, where we have it pinned down from the primary anisotropy, to more recent times, where the lensing is happening. So you pin things down at high redshift with the primary CMB, and then the power spectrum of this lensing potential, right, is some average measure of the fluctuation power at more local redshifts. And so you can combine these to study the evolution of clustering and hopefully constrain dark energy, because there is some sensitivity to lower redshifts where dark energy is important, even though the bulk of it is at higher redshifts where we expect purely matter-dominated universe and dark energy to not be doing anything important. So here is the power spectrum of the lensing field, or actually this extra factor of L squared here is because I'm plotting the makes it look like the deflection angle power spectrum. And here are some errors forecasted for all sky experiments that are pretty remarkable and include polarization as well. 4 arc minute beam and a noise of 4 microk in each arc minute pixel. So this is a this is quite an ambitious experiment. And but the point is that we can reconstruct the temperature power spectrum or the polarization power spectrum. This power spectrum can be reconstructed with very high signal to noise, right? We're sample variance limited all through here with this type of experiment. Even Planck, with errors much larger than this, produces a good measurement of the deflection of this deflection angle power spectrum. So what happens? I said, look, we can use this to learn something about dark energy. Well, in fact, it's a tough way to go. If you vary here are different plots on here varying W from -1 to -0.4 with these parameters fixed. So this is amplitude and tilt of the primordial spectrum. And here's the angular size of the sound horizon. Keep that fixed because that's going to be measured well from primary CMB. And when you vary W but keep these parameters fixed, you don't have very much change in this curve here, which is unfortunate. And the reason is that if you look at the growth factor and how it depends on omega matter and W, you see the reason why we're having trouble, that this growth factor is running quite parallel to the sound horizon here. And so if you do this at fixed sound horizon, and you vary W, but do it at fixed sound horizon, you just don't get much change at all in the growth factor. So a positively spun conclusion is that this type of measurement is great for testing for weird dark energy that is dynamically important between z equals 1100 and z equals 2. How this varies here, of course, just to, you know, this is some standard cosmology, but there's some constant W. And how do we know that dark energy isn't rearing its ugly head somewhere in between, as, for example, this oscillating model of dark energy by Kaplan-Hant, Stewart, and Bodelson? So that's applications of lensing. And now moving on to the Sneev-Zeldovich effect. So here is a picture of a cluster of galaxies taken optically, and galaxy clusters may well be our next best hope for as a system that we can hope to understand ab initio and use as a tool for cosmology, precision cosmology. But you might wonder how a galaxy cluster. If we don't understand galaxies, how are we going to understand a whole group of galaxies? And the thing to do is to look at it in a wave band where you don't see the galaxies, but just the gas that's filling this. What makes it even a possible hope that we can understand these clusters well enough to do precision cosmology is the dominant role of gravity, and that this gas is falling into this potential well, and to a zeroth order approximation, what's happening with it is just virialized, and it's at its virial temperature. And so you got this hot gas there, and in comes the CMB photon, and occasionally, maybe 1% of the CMB photons actually scatters off of the hot electrons in this cluster. And since it's optically thin to these, they don't thermalize, and you get this non-thermal spectrum coming out, where you preferentially shift the photons to higher frequencies. And so you get a deficit at low frequencies and an increment at high frequencies. And it's proportional to the optical depth of the cluster and the temperature of those electrons. So here is an image using some simulations of Martin White, processed by this undergraduate and graduate student at Davis, showing how the intensity of this cluster changes at different frequencies. If you look really closely, there's actually a little fuzz here, which is the and this is just thermal SE put in here, and this fuzz is due to relativistic corrections that you don't get that null exactly at 217. You see this unique frequency dependence and in the clusters. And then here, what you'll be seeing in talks later today, I think, is a prediction of what the diffuse SC power spectrum is due to all this stuff along the line of sight. And not only do you have this thermal effect, but you have a kinematic effect as well, which is a different frequency dependence. Unfortunately, it's the same frequency dependence as the CMB itself. But here it is for a receding cluster, and here it is for an approaching cluster. And this signal is proportional to the velocity of the cluster with respect to the microwave background. So this signal is directly telling us the is directly sensitive to the peculiar velocity of the cluster. So actually there's a way of getting peculiar velocities of clusters. Here's that figure again, in case you couldn't see it in the smaller one, with the kinematic effect here for an approaching and a receding cluster. And so how do you measure this? It's actually pointed out by Sanyev and Zeldovich in 1980 that, so here's the kinetic or kinematic effect going like V over C times tau. Of course, we don't know tau, so we have to solve for that too, and we use the thermal effect for that. The thermal effect is parameterized by this Compton parameter Y, which goes like tau times the temperature. And so you combine these to solve for V over C. You have some measurement of the temperature, perhaps from an X-ray measurement, and get the back out the velocity. So what can you do with peculiar velocity measurements? Now that, I mean, yesterday we heard about a two sigma detection of peculiar velocities, it's time to think about what you do with thousands of peculiar velocity detections. And so one application is gravitational potential reconstruction, like done with potent using galaxies. Another thing is to look at the two-point correlation function, just as we look at the two-point correlation function of anything else, and to constrain cosmological parameters, even though they're boring. And a third thing is to cross-correlate with other things, such as the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect at low redshift, and this correlation will depend on dark energy parameters. So let me talk about that first application. So here, we're not talking about any projected potential, gravitational potential like we were with lensing. We're talking about the 3D gravitational potential. And so if we consider a shallow survey, which is good for a number of reasons, one of which is you want to see these things in X-ray too, possibly, to get the temperatures, then there are 360 of these clusters in every 100 square degrees in this with this mass limit. And now if we assume, this is a big assumption, which we are currently revisiting how you do this, assume can achieve 100 kilometers per second error on every cluster within a given solid angle, then we get this conclusion worked out in this paper up here, that you can reconstruct every mode in the survey with wavelength greater than approximately 60 megaparsecs with signal noise greater than 1. And so what I'd like you to contemplate is that it's conceivable to have such a reconstruction of the potential over the entire Sloan region, although not at low redshifts. You can't actually measure these peculiar velocities for clusters that are too close to us. But how do we achieve 100 micro-k root second on the kinematic SZ? That's a step in. I mean, first you have to achieve some sensitivity on each band. And I'm talking about after you do the spectral fit and removal of all junk, how do you get down to 100 micro-k root second on kinematic SZ? And we're working on that, motivated by what we found you can do with this type of reconstruction. Now we're working on what you need to do to actually measure, actually do this. And there's also some recent papers have come out which are beginning to address this question as well. All right, so what do you do with this potential map? You can cross-correlate with everything under the sun. Another advantage of having a shallow survey is you have surveys of other things in that region too. And I'll move on to this one. You can cross-correlate with CMB temperature maps. I already mentioned this on large angular scales. And look at that, which is sensitive to what's going on with the dark energy. So I should have stuff from Sarah's talk up here and what's actually published. We don't have detections of peculiar velocities yet. But with a small beam, you might be able to see this standing out above the signal, the confusing background of CMB anisotropy. And here I put in some fiducial numbers for an expression from ancient paper by Haynelt and Tegmark, which is still quite relevant here. And so I just plugged in some fiducial values. Why these? Sorry about all the animation. Because this is in fact an overestimate of that confusing noise from CMB anisotropy, or the expected Ostreicher-Vishniac effect, or what I called earlier the kinetic SZ background. And this is some fiducial instrument noise. And with these values at an optical depth of 0.01, you get an error of 100 kilometers a second. Now this assumes that you have some coherent ball of gas all moving with the same speed, but there's significant velocity substructure. And what these papers find is that limits you to errors like this. Now this will obviously depend on the mass of the cluster, what the merger history of the cluster is, right? How much velocity substructure is actually there? And so we want to study how this actually, what this limit is for an ensemble of clusters. So there's a second application of peculiar velocities other than potential reconstruction, and that's to look at their correlations, which will depend on parameters. And what we found using a very simple-minded analysis written up in a conference proceedings here is that it only depends on omega matter. It doesn't depend on say W or the Hubble constant. And roughly, this is how the errors on omega matter scale. You might say, who cares what omega matter is? But as is emphasized in a previous paper, that I'm sure you all got the figure 17 of this paper, but I put it up here anyway, this is W down here, and this is some time derivative of W, the dark energy equation of state parameter. And this is showing what happens as you put in different priors for measuring omega matter. And so you see that having a prior on knowing something about omega matter actually makes a huge difference for whether SNAP can say anything about whether the dark energy equation of state is changing with time. And there's also a recent paper by Freeman et al. About doing this with the CMB as well. Using Planck, you can do similarly well. Make Planck plus SNAP doing similarly well on the time derivative of W. So, but as a caveat, we're not really through here. This is this calculation, instead of a simple-minded linear theory assumed throughout, and nonlinear biasing corrections are important, and Alan Peel is working on those. Okay, that's it for peculiar velocities. Now I want to move on in my last 2 minutes to what's that?
I forgot to tell you, you only have 2 minutes left.
Okay. an area of research I've been excited about recently, which is looking for a GOP trough. And I've been doing this because my colleague, Bob Becker at Davis, has gotten a lot of press for his work with the Sloan collaboration in detecting a GP trough. And I wanted such press coverage too. But the GP trough is already done, so I've moved on to the GOP trough. And so I made this plot up. I think I'm onto something. There's a number of Republican presidents in the White House as a function of time. And here we are at one for a while, and then boom, just drop down to zero. And And the big question is...
I think it's for this, though.
The big question is, does it signal the end of the Dark Ages? And actually, this is a controversial question, and you ask different people, they have very different opinions and can get quite excited about it. So this is not a settled issue, what this GOP trough means. Similarly, there's this Gunn-Peterson trough I mentioned. Now, does that imply the detection of the Dark Ages? And that is, do quasar spectra really imply reionization at Z equals 6.3? And the answer, I think, is no. It signals the end of reionization. There's certainly something happening at Z equals 6.3. But the Gunn-Peterson trough can be due to a very small amount of neutral hydrogen. And rapidly, this becomes optically thick, and you cannot see what's going on deeper in. And so there appears to be some rapid transition, but is it from an electron free electron fraction of 0, or is it from a free electron fraction of 0.5? We will not know from Gunn-Peterson troughs. But CMB polarization observations can answer this, because the Thompson scattering, which is the mechanism for this, is optically thin. So we're sensitive to the whole line of sight. Of course, it's a projected effect. What effect am I talking about? I'm talking about this low L reionization bump. It's at low L's here because polarization is generated by a quadrupole coming in. And so this is generated by a quadrupole. You'd expect it to be on large angular scales. And because we're out of time, I'll skip the fact that we've detected the polarization feature. It was just kind of model dependent. But I'll skip to the main point, which is that if you take, so usually people take a very simple model of reionization when calculating CMB power spectra, where you go at some redshift, just drop. But what if you have some step in here? How does that come out differently? And you can actually, if these annoying foregrounds that Angelica keeps bringing up aren't a problem, then and you have some cosmic variance limited experiment, you can actually get more than just tau out of this and actually learn something about the ionization history, which can answer some pretty interesting questions about when the first object started forming and pumping out enough light to reionize the IGM. And since I knew I would be out of time, I left my conclusion very short, which is this. Thanks.
We have time for a couple questions.
My impression of the most recent simulations was that they were tending to show a fairly sharp transition. And now, the quick answer is no. Now, I know that you know there are simulations where you have broader ones, but it's the guidance from simulations is difficult because you can really be affected by very small scale stuff, as you know. Analytic arguments about what's going on are very important in figuring out what the possibilities could be here. I don't trust the simulations. I guess I don't try to take the simulations seriously enough yet to actually plug them in. I hadn't thought about it either. So.
Some honesty. One more question.
Right.
And so, in some sense, to do this realistically, frequency is also needed. You should be, KLO distribution.
Exactly. And yeah.
So, and I guess when you talk about about reconstructing potentials to what extent we thought about the actual distribution.
Well, that's exactly what we want to do. So the studies of what you can do in principle with clusters, with real simulated clusters, has just started happening. I mean, there's a couple of papers out, you know, just this month about what that each use at most three clusters, and don't even say what the optical depth of the clusters is, so that is a research program of ours, is to figure out what are the errors for an ensemble. How does angular resolution affect what you get out?
Let's hold off now and thank Lloyd again. So if we move on, we'll have more questions.
Our next speaker.